back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week is Ruth Singer. Ruth, welcome.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Oh, boy. We're going to be here for 3 hours, I think.
Yes.
I think that the best way to describe you is the quote you have I found somewhere in all your writings, that you work mainly with old cloth, often damaged, torn, and worn, which I combine with hand stitch, natural dye, quilting, applique, and mixed media to create subtle and emotive pieces. Yep, that's what you do.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the things I do, yeah. It's part of what I do. My textile practice is part of a whole package of kind of portfolio career, I think it's called now. So I do lots of other things as well, which is a lot of teaching, working with people, teaching, writing, sharing my work. But in order to make this, like, you know, shorter than 3 hours, hopefully we'll just talk about the textile practice rather than all of the rest of the million things I do.
Oh, yeah. For people listening, RuthSinger.com, and you, there are books, magazine, podcasts, projects. It's an endless thing. We'll never cover all of it by a long shot. But before, all right, so we're going to talk about your projects, because I think that's the most interesting way to get a sense of what you do and how you go about it. But I have to hear the story about Aunt Anne Goodstein. Sounds like she was a big part of it.
Yeah, I think unlike most textile artists, I didn't grow up learning textiles with my mum or my granny, because my mum doesn't make. And my granny, that was a professional seamstress, she died before I was born. So I didn't get to learn from her. So I didn't grow up surrounded by textiles like most people. But my aunt, she did so, and she did make things, and she was really interested in fashion and textiles and history. And so she was a big influence on me, even if though she didn't particularly teach me sewing, but just hugely influential as a person. So sadly, she died very young, and she was 46 when I was a teenager. And, you know, that obviously has a big impact on the whole family. But it's something I wanted to make a memorial piece about her when I was doing a whole project about called Emotional Repair. And I wanted to make some pieces that were about personal emotional stories. And one of the concepts that I came up with was to make a memorial piece about her or for her. And that actually, it was a kind of slow process of, all of my work is very slow in terms of the making, but also the thinking process. It can take me a long time to work out what I want to make. I've got a concept, and then I work out how I'm going to make it into something. So it took quite a long time for me to work out that what I was going to make was pincushions. And that was because I'd been doing research on pincushions and looking at historic pincushions and how they were used as given as gifts and memorial pieces, forget-me-not pieces. You get forget-me-not pinned decoratively into pincushions, and they were given at births of children. And anyway, it's, you know, in the 17th century. So it felt like an interesting concept to explore. So I made 46 of them to represent the 46 years of her life. Mm. And each of those pincushions is a different material, antique textiles, hand stitching, all sorts of different things. So they've all got really complex kind of meaning behind them. And that really, as part of the way I've developed my work over the last few years, is that there is a story, this narrative, a meaning behind everything that I do. So every choice that I make with materials or stitch, or decoration or pattern, there is a meaning to it rather than purely decorative. That's just the way that I work. So that's how kind of that's where that project came from. So that's gone straight into a kind of like a sad story to start off with. But I think because I've done a number of projects that are about kind of the tougher side of human experience, there's an assumption, people seem to assume that that's kind of what I'm like, but I'm not actually quite a cheerful person, really. I just find the more hidden stories more interesting creatively. So that's why I go down those kind of routes.
She is not a depressed, sad person.
Right, right. So how do you organize something like that? Because here you've got, you're trying to do something for somebody's life, 1 year of their life. Did you keep like a separate notebook for each year? Did you have like, or a,
No, nothing is organized. It is more intuitive, I suppose. Once I'd come up with the concept, I started making, and actually, I say it actually took me several years, because I started making the series for an exhibition that I had in 2015, didn't get it finished. So I didn't mention that it was supposed to be 46 pincushions. And then a couple of years later, I had another show, another opportunity to exhibit that work alongside some other work. So I finished it off. So it actually happened. I produced it over the course of about 3 or 4 years in the end. So it's more that kind of each idea led to another one. So I'd explore some with some antique textile and think, oh, actually, it would be really nice to. She collected, for example, she collected blue and white antique porcelain. So I wanted to have blue and white fabrics in there. So it took a while before I found the right blue and white fabrics. So, yeah, there's nothing that they're not representative of an individual year. They're just a number in okay. total number. Yeah.
Right. So, but it did represent to you her life.
Yes. Yes.
What you knew of her. Yeah, obviously. Okay. I just wondering, because here you are probably started collecting blue textiles, and I would think, okay, this is not quite the right blue, but what do I need? You know, I don't know, a notebook of some sort where you staple samples of.
Yeah, I mean, I've got bits and pieces like that. I never used to at that time. Yeah, this is a few years back now. I never used to keep very good records or very good kind of sketchbooks. But now I've developed, I actually do that as part of my practice now, is what I call them project books. So they're not sketchbooks because there's no drawing generally in them. There's a lot of notes and samples and ideas and bits and pieces floating around. So I, for every project I do, so every sort of concept or idea that I'm exploring has its own sketchbook, project book. So now I would probably have a clearer record of my thinking process. Whereas then it's like scraps and pieces of paper and notes here and there, rather than anything that I could kind of pull out and show to people. But I've learned over the years to create, because so much of my work is about sharing. So with exhibitions and teaching and running my membership and things, I'm always kind of talking about my creative process, sharing what I do. So having my sketchbooks, my working documents, kind of available is really, really beneficial to that, because it kind of illustrates what I'm talking about when it doesn't necessarily, there isn't necessarily a finished piece of work to show for it. Sometimes it's just exists in the sketchbook.
Yeah, I'm thinking I've got, I'm going to be working a 17th century casket, and I started it and then I stopped, and I'm thinking, you know what I need to do is keep a notebook with it and take notes on what I'm doing. Because while I started working, my mind immediately started changing the design. And I thought, now I can't remember what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
So, because I didn't write it down. And so that's why I'm curious. I'm always asking artists, you know, do you keep some sort of sketchbook? Do you keep some sort of notebook? What do you put in that notebook? Because I am very disorganized. So I have post-it notes all over the place. And I'm like, my kids will come and they'll say, okay, what's this post-it note, Mom? And it seems like it needs to be a little bit more organized. So a notebook sort of concept. Yeah. And I just wondered, because you do such a variety of work. So like if you're doing cyanotype work, it doesn't always work the first time. Ask me how I know.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you could probably keep notes on those sort of things, too.
No.
No, you don't.
No,
just I'm experiment, really huh?
Technical notes. I know. When I've done quite a lot of printmaking over the years in a specialist print studio, and I always think I should make notes on this so I can remember how to do it, and I don't. So no, I'm actually quite disorganized. So I keep thematic notes, ideas is what I keep notes of. I'm not very good at the technical details. Quite often, like a course I've taught. And I think, oh, yeah, I can run that course again. Where are my notes? Oh, I didn't keep any notes. So I have to reproduce it all again.
Right.
So, no, not as organized as.
I feel much better now. I feel so much better. Yeah. Because why take notes? You know, I just go and if I do some sort of printing, I just throw it. Someone says, well, how do you do it? I was like, I paint it on, I throw it outside, it makes a print or it doesn't make a print, you know?
Yeah. It's an experimental process, is always good.
Right, right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, the one thing when I first started looking at your work is you describe yourself as a maker. Mm-hmm. And, you know, encountered other people who are makers in one form or another, but you truly are. I mean, textile art is at the foundation of it, mm-hmm. but you truly are a maker, take an idea, concept, and make something out of it. And it's fun to go through and watch how you've developed each of these ideas.
Yeah, I do. I think I've started using the term artist maker, which I think probably, I don't know if it exists outside of my own head. I don't think anybody else really using that, because the making that I do is kind of concept driven, ideas driven, rather than functional. Partly, which I guess my early career, I was a more functional maker. I made kind of bags, scarves, cushions, that kind of textile products. And as I've moved on from making things you can use to artwork, I've kind of shifted how I describe myself. So the artist maker kind of covers both, that making, you know, the materials and the technical skills are really important to me, but also so are the ideas, and the two have to go together for me in terms of what I count as my own work. You know, I make functional things, you know, I make quilts for use. And I make, you know, occasionally make clothes, don't do it very often anymore, but I can do that kind of functional sewing and making. But my own creative artist practice tends to all be non-functional kind of work. So artist maker kind of sits a bit better, but it makes sense to me, whether it makes sense to anyone else.
So, all right, the projects are what really tell the story. So this Cultures of Care umbrella project, and mm-hmm. there's so many things underneath that. So how did this come to be?
Yeah, it came to be in its actual sense because I have funding for that. So we have in the
always
UK
helps.
Arts Council, who you can apply to for funding creative projects with a public engagement aspect to them. So it's not just for artist practice, it's for working and sharing with other people. So, and I've done that, I've been working in that way for quite a long time, so I'm familiar with that process and what they're after. So, which is great for me, it means I'm in a position to be able to apply for that funding fairly regularly. So I had a concept that I wanted to explore, which was about care, and I was able to turn it into a kind of project, a fundable project. So that's why it's got a whole load of different elements, including exhibitions and public engagement and community projects. So they're all of the elements that are needed to make it a fundable project. Luckily for me, I also love doing those bits. So I don't feel like that, then I don't have to add on bits in order to make it fundable, because working with other people is really fundamental to how I work creatively. So fortunately for me, it works really well that the two go together, rather than having to kind of separate them out. But the Cultures of Care concept came from several years of doing work that was about, like I mentioned, my emotional repair exhibition, you know, talking about memorials and loss and grief and all kinds of difficult subjects, and approaching them with care. So when I was, you know, sharing personal stories, it was always about being careful about that. And I did a big project that finished a couple of years ago called Criminal Quilts, which is looking at the stories of women who were in prison in a local prison in the 19th century, and a series of photographs that exist in the local archive of those women. And I did over 10 years worth of work on them, and it had a lot of attention. But something I had to keep repeating was that I am approaching these women and their stories with care. I don't want to sort of sensationalize, and I don't want to glamorize because they're basically women who are very, very poor and having really, really tough lives and very few choices and ended up in prison for just, you know, stealing stuff in order to be able to pay their rent, buy food. You know, so it's, I've always approached that as a kind of, my work about them was an act of care, you know, kind of in retrospective, act of care towards them, and that I want the work that I do to be caring, to be sensitive, to be emotional. And what I realized last year was that a lot of my previous work could come under this kind of umbrella term, this banner of care, without me really realizing that was a term I could use about my work. But somebody else reflected it back to me and said, well, your work's all about care. Mm. Oh, yeah. So it is. I hadn't really, you know, all of these disparate or fairly disparate different ideas and projects that I've been working on, they all kind of come together. So I decided to create that as a specific project title or umbrella that I could then work with a number of different elements of the community engagement exhibitions, my own personal research and making my own body of work that were all under that umbrella. I mean, umbrella, I like the, you know, umbrella term works very well, but I think of it as a basket, like with loads of balls of wool or something like that, that they all fit together, or a sewing box with all sorts of different bits that fit in. So it's got lots of different elements, but they all contribute to different underrepresented or underexplored stories about care. So for my purposes, you know, care can be interpreted in those different ways. For my purposes, it's about caring for nature, caring for the planet, caring for people, and caring for... I'm working with museums, so I talk about caring for objects, but it's more about museums and community stories, collective histories, and the underexplored stories that come up in museum collections. So it's a whole variety of different ways of working and different ideas to explore, but it's giving me the opportunity to try some things that have been kind of at the back of my mind for ages, and I haven't had the space to really dig into them. So yeah, that's the background of it.
Yeah. Well, and the Criminal Quilts one, mm-hmm, is, you know, the title Criminal Quilts kind of gives you an initial reaction. But when, mm-hmm, you look into it, at least it struck me as, this is not a story of criminals. It's a story of survival. I mean, it really is tragic that these women have been put in this position to, mm-hmm, become criminals to survive. But, capture that, yeah.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, it's looking at the story, the wider story from a different angle. So they might have been looked at as criminal statistics, as mugshots, as, you know, lots of people treat them as non-human, you know, not important, of no value historically in the terminology that's used in the Victorian documents about them. You know, it's not, there's no empathy in that kind of world. So, and I see that as the role of the artist, that, you know, I can come in and kind of reinterpret, look at those stories afresh and create something different from them and take a different perspective. And that's the way I try and approach all of my projects, is to look at them from an angle that other people might not have done or haven't done as an artist.
Yeah. Now, you have a book about the Criminal Quilts, then.
Yes.
And that tells the stories of, mm-hmm, of a number of these women.
Yeah, it's got kind of broader stories. So the whole collection of photographs that I worked from, there's 9 photograph albums of women from the 1870s to the First World War. So I've kind of told a bit of the story of each of those date periods. They're not consecutive, there's massive gaps, you know, there's periods where we've got loads of information and some with none, and then also in the archive there is written records that go with them, but they don't necessarily match up. So there might be written records from one decade but no photographs, and photographs and no written records, so there's all sorts of gaps. So it was I had a lot of volunteers working on doing that research with me, and we looked into all sorts of different elements. They did a lot of research of looking at the individuals and tracking some of them through ancestry and looking at their personal stories. And I did kind of broader research about, you know, women in prisons and particularly about prison clothing. I did a lot of research on things like that, that kind of more textile link as well. So the book contains all of that research and then all of my textile work that I made for the first exhibition in 2018. So, and the previous work that I'd made, because I'd been working on it for a few years by then. So there was a big chunk of mostly quilts at that point. I was mostly making quilts. Often confuses people that they're quilts I've made inspired by the stories of criminals, not quilts made by criminals. Which always confuses people. Often get that one. People often, so, you know, I probably picked a wrong title, but it works. It worked at the time. And since the book came out, I did carry on working on it for another couple of years and did some additional work, which mostly isn't even quilts. So I kind of allowed myself to go off. This is where, you know, I stray off in different directions. So I've done pieces working with a jeweler and working with a fine artist and painter and all sorts of different elements to that. So it could have kept growing. I could have carried on working on that theme, just that theme, for the rest of my life. But I always had this other work going on, this kind of personal and emotional stories that never really got quite the attention that it deserved, because the criminals were taking up all of my all of my kind of public capacity. So I kind of put them away now. I've made the conscious decision to end that project. So I'm no longer making work along that theme. The exhibition tour has concluded. The books are still for sale and I still do talks about it. Obviously still comes up a lot because it's a really it's got a lot to it, you know, and there's plenty more to say. But I wanted to look at some other stories, which is why the Cultures of Care project came about, because I was ready for kind of revisiting some of the things I'd started working on other projects. This kind of the more emotional histories is how I'm describing it now, kind of which criminal quilts covered, but in a very specific area only, whereas I can be a bit more broad now. By creating the Cultures of Care basket of different projects.
Yeah. And in this, it's interesting to me. It always amazes me how many museums exist that, you know, the small ones that we don't hear about, don't learn about. And in the UK, there must be one on every corner, because it sure seems like there's a ton of them. But, you awful lot of work with museums to create all of this work.
Yeah, well, that comes from my background, my training, my first career, it was in museums. So it's really fundamental to how I work. I mean, yeah, there used to be more museums than there are now. When I was a child, we had costume museums in both of the cities near me, and neither of them exist anymore. So, you know, I have to make the most of what there is left. But because that my training and my 20s working in museums, that kind of research way of working, so I'd explore around a subject, around an object, and finding out all the different angles that might be interesting, I think that is why I work creatively in the way I work now, that I'm interested in the underrepresented stories, the things people don't always know about a particular subject, because that's how I was trained to look at museum collections and museum objects. So as much as possible, I do try and work directly with museums or in archives and historic collections or buildings, because I find, you know, material stuff really interesting, especially when my work is quite concept driven, you know, with ideas about, you know, my projects is about care, and it's quite hard to make sense of that, what it actually means. Yeah. But when I'm looking at collections care, so I'm looking at how we look after objects in a museum context and what is considered worth caring for or what is considered not important, are quite interesting creatively in terms of the value judgments and things that will be created around objects. So there's lots of different elements to it, but I just think museums are great. They're just really, really fascinating. They're always interesting. I mean, not all museums. I have my preferences, textiles, obviously. And the older the better. You know, I'm not great with an industrial museum and aeroplanes and that kind of thing. I struggle with that. But I worked for 3 years earlier in my career in a transport museum. So I worked with London buses and tube trains. So, you know, I think I probably I had my fill of that kind of thing. And now I'm like, you know, let me get back to the 17th century embroideries, please, because I feel more at home with them. Yeah. But it's to do with hand making. That's what I find most interesting. That's what I'm interested in, those older handmade objects, particularly textiles, obviously. Yeah. And that's what I always get drawn back to.
Yeah, the Blossom and Thorn
mm-hmm.
project. Now, I learned that you have the Making Meaning podcast and then the journal. And you've just you got your first edition of the Making Meaning journal. Mm-hmm. The Blossom and Thorn project, I did not know about hedges.
No, apparently you don't have them so much in the US.
No. What an amazing thing. Wow.
So the best way to describe them is linear woodlands. So they're sort of rows of trees, but here they can be 200-400 years old, mostly under 200 years old, which is still pretty old. But there are some really, really old ones, and they're just really interesting. And, you know, they were created to keep animals in mostly, but also to keep people out. But they have survived the industrialization of our agricultural system in some places. We've lost thousands of miles of them in the last 50 years, but there are still plenty left. And I moved town a couple of years ago, and I'm back in my hometown now, and I'm living on the very edge of the housing, and then there are fields and with loads of hedges, and there are lots of footpaths, so I can walk very easily out up into the countryside, which is, you know, I forget other people can't, you know, lots of places you can't do that, but here you can. And a lot of those footpaths run along these old, they're very old roads that have stayed as footpaths rather than being turned into roads. So they still have their old hedgerows along sometimes one side, usually both. And, you know, at various different points of year, they're in the winter, they're completely bare, just kind of showing their tree structure. And then in the summer, they're covered in leaf and blossom and have birds nesting in them. And, you know, you get mice living under them, and therefore you get birds of prey hunting over them. And when they're at their best, they can be quite degraded and not been looked after for 50 years. So sometimes they are looking a bit thin and sparse, but at their best, they are amazing. And they're kept trimmed to kind of below human head height, kind of shoulder height, probably. So you can kind of see over them until they grow up, go wild. So they're kind of, you can have quite old trees, but they still stay quite small because they're kind of pruned every year to keep them quite contained. But they are interesting culturally and aesthetically and environmentally. You know, they're really interesting things. And the idea of my project was worked with volunteers in a specific area of the National Forest, which is a new forestry plantation in England, where I asked volunteers to go and go for a walk on this particular long distance footpath and report back on what they found. And I then made some artworks representing some of the findings, some of the things that they found or they identified, and particularly looking at where they could identify old hedges or the number of species, the different tree species in the hedge, and all sorts of different elements. And I used some of their photographs, and I used some of my own kind of research walks as well to create a series of long strips of textile that were each told an element of the story, of the data and of the ideas about hedges, the thoughts about hedges. And then they were originally made to be displayed in an old hedge, which is basically some overgrown trees. So it's stopped being cut as a hedge and turned into kind of straggly trees. So I actually, a festival. So I actually displayed them in this hedge a couple of months ago, which was a really interesting way of working because I'd never done putting my textiles outside and leaving them for 3 days, which is it feels quite risky because it was a very wet weekend as well, a lot of it. So there was a massive thunderstorm. And when I went to collect my work at the end of the weekend, it was all soaking wet, but it didn't actually come to any harm. It was actually fine. And so it was a really interesting thing when I'm used to exhibiting in a gallery, you know, you've got walls, you've got corners, you've got nails to hang things on. And now I just had a bit of tree and just had to just hope that nobody damaged it or ran off with it or anything. You know, it was a kind of quite an interesting way of working because particularly from my museum background, I've been trained to be looking after the textiles and you don't handle them and you know, you wrap them in acid-free tissue and you keep them in the dark,
right?
When you're looking at antique pieces. So then go, yeah, it's fine. I'll just hang them in this hedge and leave them unattended for 3 days. Was quite a difficult concept, but I loved it. I loved doing it. And I loved the engagement it created. So with the volunteers who worked with me, they said things like, you know, I've never looked so closely at this something that I walk past every day. You know, something that is really familiar for us in this country. They're very familiar old hedgerows, you know, but to properly focus on them, to properly pay attention. And that was what the purpose was for me, was to encourage that kind of close attention and paying attention and close observation and thinking about what they mean in the culturally and personally. So, you know, it's a kind of, it's a taster of what I would like to do more about all sorts of different elements of social and cultural history that we have around us that we don't even notice so much.
Yeah, you filled in a lot of blanks for me with that project because I follow a number of cyclists who live in northern England and they ride on these footpaths. I mean, there's these paths everywhere and I'm so jealous because they can just go ride anywhere and no traffic. And then, so they'll, of course there's plantings all along and you know, the word hedgerow, that just sounds to me like somebody planted stuff and they keep it trimmed. But then when you show how they actually make hedgerows, by bending trees and tying them off and then maintaining that, it's just a fascinating thing. And then to embellish that with your art was really fun to see.
Great. Yeah. I think the thing with cyclists, the reason they don't necessarily like hedgerows, a lot of the plants that are used in hedges is a hawthorn, which has these huge great thorns on it. It's really good at puncturing your bike tires.
Yes.
So that's the downside of it, of when there are those, they're vicious spikes that on the thorns. So yeah, can be problematic for cyclists, but otherwise it's a lovely environment to be in. They're really, they can be really kind of, sometimes they're really high. So when, if you're walking, cycling on a little road and they're way above your head height, it's almost like in a little tunnel and they are wonderful things.
Are they protected there in England then? Or
it's not really.
Okay.
Kind of, yeah. You can't rip them out. I mean, you know, until the 1980s, you could just rip them out. But now you technically can't. But landowners still do, which is it's contentious. Yeah, because they're not as protected as they're protected in that you can't rip them out, but you don't have to look after them. So. It's a bit kind of like having a historic building. You can't knock it down, but you don't have to look after it. So it's tricky. It's not an ideal situation, no.
And the reason I'm asking is there's a place called the Natchez Trace here, and you can see the old trace line. And it's sunken because so many people walked on it.
Yeah.
But there's only a few sections left that are like that. And they did finally protect the whole, it's just a narrow strip of land and bicycle. There's a road there, but you can't go fast on it. They don't allow trucks on the road and you step off the road to find these sunken bits. And we ended up, and I'm so glad that they got the funds and they protected that because it is a total step back in time when you step onto those, sunken places where all these people, it feels like you're stepping back in history. And I would think that the hedgerows would be the same thing.
Yeah. When they're in footpaths, I mean, we have them on alongside the road as well. You know, they can be quite busy roads sometimes. But there is, you know, having these very old paths is it is absolutely stepping back into history. And that's something that I'm working on a project now, doing something similar to the hedges, but looking at footpaths and all these walking routes, which, you know, we're cutting between different farms and different villages across the countryside. And we've got thousands and thousands of miles of them. And they're not always that well looked after or protected or easy to access. You know, they're like farm animals on the fields and stuff, you know. And sometimes barbed wire and all sorts of things, all sorts of issues happen. But, you know, we are very fortunate to have those, even though there's, you know, there's limitations and issues with them. But historically, I think it's really interesting people walking all the time. You know, it's not that long ago that everybody walked everywhere all the time. And this is the sort of thing that I go off on these kind of creative meanders about. How can I make some work to do with walking on old footpaths? And one day it'll filter through, the idea and the material will come together, and then, you know, I'll be able to produce something. But for a while, there's the idea floating around and it's waiting for its kind of material partner to come to my mind, and I work out how it comes together. That's why my work often takes me a very long time, because I don't like to rush into making something just because I've had an idea. I have to wait for the idea and the material to match up. And sometimes it comes straight away and sometimes it can take years. So it's a slow process.
Right. When I saw your hedgerows cloths, I wondered if they were sort of like the prayer cloths, the prayer banners that people have been putting out and actually, you know, and leaving out. A lot of people put them up, like they'll make these little quilts. And then they'll hang them out and leave them outside and let them disintegrate, basically, because we all know that those textiles. And that was interesting that you went back and that it bothered you to leave them out like that. And
it was for a specific event,
right?
Over a weekend, so I just had them up for this specific event. I do like the idea of leaving something out permanently. I mean, I've done it a few times in buildings where I've made pieces of work that are kind of hidden in the building and kind of go back and see what happens. And they mostly all just end up, I mean, I made tiny pieces that like slotted into little gaps and cracks in the wall and like round pipes and things. And eventually they all fell off and I think they probably got hoovered up. You know, because that was in the old studio building that I used to have a space in, and I'm not there anymore, so I haven't been to check on them, whether any of it's still there or not. I think they just kind of get sort of swept up in the dust, but I don't know. But it is an interesting idea of like making work and then just kind of leaving it to see what happens and kind of relinquishing ownership of it, which is quite difficult when you've spent hours, days making something.
Yeah.
So, right.
But I think it's creatively, I think it's an interesting way of working, of not having this possessiveness. But then that comes a problem of like, I'm an artist that needs to exhibit, you know. I go, well, I haven't got anything to exhibit because I left it out for the birds to make a nest in, which is creatively interesting, but you don't have a lot to show for it, which is why I do a lot of photography and writing about my work, because some of it is more kind of ephemeral or short term, you know, and it maybe needs to. It's not going to work in an exhibition, you know. I have shown Blossom and Thorn, the hedgerows project, in a couple of exhibitions, but it's completely different without a hedge. It's a bit
right.
Not quite right without its hedge. So, yeah, don't know where that's going to end up. But it's always interesting to try different ways of sharing my work and seeing how it works in a different context. If it's made for a specific location, it's completely different in another one. So if it was made to go in a museum, you know, in a historic building, and then goes into a white space gallery, it feels very different, because it's kind of, the scale is different and the atmosphere of the room and just the physically how it fits in the space is completely different. And I just find that sort of stuff really interesting, of how things work in different spaces.
You took me through a little journey with the blossom and thorn with the hedgerow thing, because mm-hmm. then I was reading about your nature nurture idea of mm-hmm. wrapping trees in quilts.
Yeah.
And when you talked about how you didn't want it to look like it was a setup for a photo shoot, mm-hmm. and you were trying to convey a concept of caring about nature. And, mm-hmm. and you showed pictures of the quilts. And then I thought, well, how did she handle that with the hedgerows? So I went mm-hmm. back to look at that art to see if you had, if it blended in with the hedgerows.
Yeah.
As opposed to the quilts, which some of them are rather stark, whitish wraps yes. around trees. So it yeah. was interesting just to see how you handled the two different things. And mm. I appreciate the quilt thing is an ongoing project, but
yeah, that was an experiment with some existing quilts to see how they worked on trees. And I did notice, you know, I didn't like the way they stood out if they were really contrasting, like you say, the light color or bright colors. I didn't actually like that aesthetically. So I hadn't connected the two together, even though I've written about them in the same Making Meaning journal that you're talking about. But now you're saying that, I did probably think about the colours for Blossom and Thorn after I'd experimented with the quilt. So that probably was in my mind, because originally the Blossom and Thorn was going to be much brighter colours. And I decided, actually, I ended up making it in the kind of dark browns and greens that completely blended in with the woodland, to the point where my work was like quite hard to see from, if you weren't right in front of it, you wouldn't necessarily notice it, because I didn't want it to look like colorful flags, you know, because it was more depth to that. It's not just a decorative device. So I made them blend in so much that they kind of disappeared, which was interesting again to contemplate. So when I do come back to the wrapping trees with quilts, I might try and find something halfway in between. So right. they're not really stark, but they also don't disappear completely. So people who actually see them, or maybe I should make them so they just look like trees. I don't know. It'd be interesting to try that. Make some that really blend in that aren't obvious at all and see how that feels. But
yeah. it was interesting mental exercise. Cause yeah. How do you convey caring for nature by wrapping mm-hmm. trees in quilts without making them look just way out of place?
And
you could do a camouflage thing and make them disappear visually, but do you really want to do that? Yeah, that's a tough one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. it's interesting to get your reflections on it. Thank you. That's really, really useful. It's why I like sharing these things, even when they're only ideas.
Yeah.
Because, you know, feedback, conversations with other people is what makes it exciting for me. I really appreciate any kind of responses. So it's always good to get that.
Yeah. Well, they're interesting project. All right. Got to hear about the family clothing project.
Mm-hmm. So
that seems to have been a real battle all the way through to get what you wanted.
Yeah. It was, again, this was a case of it being very slow. I mean, partly it was slow because the original kind of project started up in 2020, and it was, you know, I couldn't meet up with the friend who donated the textile collection. So I was, you know, not in a creative space in lockdown. It didn't work well for me, kind of doing kind of experimental creative textiles things when everything seemed so difficult. So it took a long time before I got going with it. But the background is that a friend had a collection of family clothing and textiles that her mother had created. And after her mother had died, she didn't know what to do with this lot of stuff. You know, many people have the same situation of inheriting things from relatives and they don't really know what to do with it. But they knew it's too nice to send to a charity shop or too interesting. So my friend asked me to create an artwork from the textiles, and then she'd have the textiles back. And in the time it took me to not get around to starting or to be still thinking about it, she eventually decided she didn't want the textiles back and that I could keep them, which means I've now got a huge box of somebody else's family history. Quite know what I'm going to do with that. She's kind of offloaded the problem onto me.
That's how I'm seeing it. Yeah.
Yeah. But at the moment, they're still they're kind of connected to the artwork that I've produced. So they're kind of belong together at the moment, and I'll try and work out what to do with them in the long term. But what I just, my, because they came in this kind of beautifully packaged in an archival box and kind of museum quality storage, because my friend had, she used to work in that world, same as me. So she, it would kind of come almost like having a bit of a museum delivered to my doorstep. And so I started the original concept. I started working on the idea of making some small artworks that didn't use the textiles. So I didn't cut anything up, didn't stitch into any of the cloth. And so it would stay as a kind of almost like a museum collection, preserved, untouched, undamaged. And then I would make artworks that were inspired by it rather than from it. And that shifted a little bit when she decided she didn't want them back. So I did use some of the textiles to make some of the pieces. So I've made a whole series of small pieces that all fit in a box, an archive box. So they're kind of, it's the, my idea was it's like the experience of when you go to an archive or a museum to do research with works on paper, so prints and drawings and photographs. They tend to be in these archival boxes in a stack with maybe with acid-free tissue between them. So I wanted to make a pin artwork that was like that. So that same kind of experiences, you have to lift one out and see the next and see the next. So all of the pieces I made are kind of rectangular and flat mostly. And I experimented with techniques that don't use the textiles or don't damage the textiles. So I've used drawing, I've used cyanotype, I've done rubbings using graphite, I've done kind of cut work designs, taking designs from some of the edging, and I've done a lot of photography, photographing the pieces, manipulating the photographs and having them printed on archival paper. A couple of pieces that are photographs printed onto fabric, which I then stitched into. And then towards the end, I also added in a couple of pieces where I've actually used some of the textile, some of the garments, but stitched in a very kind of conservation inspired. So a very light touch stitch that could all be removable. So I've just folded the cloth rather than cutting it. And I've used very kind of clear stitching that could be taken out. So I've kind of followed a almost conservation methodology of only doing things that are removable and that don't cause any permanent change to the object. So we're kind of like a lot of museum theory almost going into how I've approached that artwork. So now I've got this box of about 20, 25, I'm not sure how many pieces of these miniature artworks that tell elements of the story of the family collection, but aren't trying to, it's not obvious what the stories are. You know, you need to kind of need a person alongside with it, talking it through, explaining what's in there. But, you know, focusing on little details, like one of the child's shoe which are always powerful kind of objects and metaphors, but one of the children in the family died young. So these baby shoes, whereas, you know, she didn't, you know, so that was the one I wanted to use. I wanted to use that child's shoe as the symbolic. So you wouldn't know that in the artwork without my explanation alongside it. I also photographed holes and I looked at edges at that kind of, like, you know, there's all sorts of complex meanings in there that I can't keep track of all of them myself, because it's similar to when I was working with the pincushions that I started talking about at the beginning. They kind of, it grew organically. I started on one piece and that gave me some ideas for the next piece, rather than planning, I'm going to make 25 pieces and seven of them will be in this technique and seven of them will be in this technique. I just started making and seeing what came up. So I took maybe 100 photographs and I've used five. Yeah. You know, because they're the five most interesting ones. So, you know, there's always a lot more out kind of around the artwork than is visible in the finished artwork. There's always a lot more, a lot of extra thinking and processes and ideas and experiments, things that didn't work, things that just live in the sketchbook because they were disaster, terrible cyanotypes that didn't work, accidental things. But it was a really interesting process of working through kind of non-intervention, non-damaging processes, but there was still very textile, you know, still about the fibres and the fabrics and the materials and the hand making, without without actually using the fabric. So it was, yeah, really enjoyable project. Really, it's been really interesting to share that one as well.
Yeah, but for your friend, it's out of stuff that normally would have gone to a resale shop or just gone to the trash. You've created a bit of family history. I'm sure that will, for years, be valued at family gatherings.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think the situation with this one is that she's pretty much the last of the family left. I think that's the thing. That's why she was kind of left with this collection that she didn't really know. She hadn't got anybody to pass it on to. Now, what do you do with it when you're kind of the end of the family line? And I am, for one side of my family, I'm kind of the end of the line. So I think everything, you know, I don't know what will happen to it once I'm gone. But these are the kind of things I think about quite a lot because of my museum background and, you know, my kind of, I have a bit of a inclination to collect things, textiles. So, you know, I've got enough of my own stuff without acquiring other people's things.
And I think that's the problem, you know, because I have things that belong to both my maternal grandmother and I think my husband's great grandmother, like her bloomers. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, you love textiles. Here you go. And I'm like, okay, now what? they have a story. They both have a story. Mm-hmm. And I know the stories of these two ladies, which are completely different. Their backgrounds. And I'd love to tell their story with their textiles. Mm. But
it,
I hold,
it becomes a burden, doesn't it? It's a bit kind of an emotional burden that you've got to, I'm now responsible for these.
Right.
This archive. What do I do with it? Especially what always makes me smile with particularly things, you know, like the bloomers and the petticoats and this. How did people feel if we knew that, like, in 100 years, somebody would be, like, packaging up your underwear and giving it to your great-great-grandchildren? That's quite a weird idea, isn't it? How I feel about it. I'm not sure how they would feel about it, knowing that their secret, their hidden intimate garments were being passed around their descendants. But it's very common. I don't quite know why. It's an odd thing to end up keeping, but... And that does seem to be what was kept.
Right. Yeah. And you wonder why, you know, she must have had beautiful clothes, the bloomers. Yeah. I know that, like, the piece of that's my own maternal grandmother's, she was making a tablecloth. And I'm sure it was going to be an altar cloth, actually, for church. So it never got finished. And it's out of a very rough piece of fabric. So it's interesting that... Mm. And then this other's got lace on it and, you know, crocheted lace and very fancy. And this is, you know, the difference in these two ladies' lives. It's juxtaposition.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we have the ongoing question of Beth's casket. And then what is Beth doing with the bloomers? Okay. This is, yeah.
Yeah, great. Always something at my house, huh?
All right, we're going to run out of time here, and Ruth, you do have a business, and so we want to talk about how people can get involved with that, because your maker members, and then I'm fascinated by your 2023 theme of damage. So so how does your business work? How do people get involved with you and participate in all of these things?
That's a lot of, there's a lot of things going on there. So yeah, my maker membership is an online group that I set up during the pandemic as a way of connecting creative people who are interested in the ideas and the way I work rather than textile processes and techniques. So it's more about, I talk about doing research and how to approach research, how to turn that research into something, how to build more of this meaning and stories and narratives into whatever it is you're making. So I have textile people, painters, and writers, and all sorts of people, creative practices are in the membership group. And one of the opportunities that I create for the membership is an online exhibition once a year. And next year's exhibition in the early part of the year will be about damage. So the idea of that is part of the CARE project, the Cultures of CARE project. And it was going to tie in with an exhibition that I have myself in a museum, which was going to be about damage. And I say going to be because it's all had to change since I planned it all. Because creative problem solving is part of my my multiple jobs that I do. So that exhibition is now something else, but the damage theme is the membership are all busy working on that. So they're creating some new work around that theme. So that's just one of the ways that I like to support the membership by with learning and experimenting and trying new things. So the membership is a monthly program. You can join for a month at a time, and that's open all the time. And then I also have my podcast, Making Meaning, which is just started the new series after quite a long break, but we are back now. I've got lots happening. I've recorded several episodes. Can't remember in the last few days. I've done loads. So that's where I have conversations with other artists and creatives, sometimes with coaches and writers, about the meaning behind their work or the stories behind what they do, the kind of the hidden histories kind of thing that I'm really interested in. So those are once a fortnight. And then I have a lot of ongoing bits and pieces. I have the Making Meaning Journal, which you've been talking about kindly, which is a small digital publication sharing some more of the background of my work and some of those stories. So there'll be another issue of that in the new year, alongside my exhibition, which is in the UK. So if you have any listeners in the UK, you'll be able to come to that. And I can't remember what else. I probably do loads more other things, but I can't remember them. Yeah. Right now. That's
talk about this damage theme. What?
Okay.
And you've got what Karen Logan and Mandeep. I'm not even going to try that last name.
Yeah.
How does that whole work?
So that's a different. This is where it's had to change. I've had to change the project in order because of some issues with the museum I was working with. So it was going to be a whole project about damage.
Oh.
In the exhibition. So now that's just the membership working on that. And my exhibition, which will be, there will be an online version as well, so everybody will be able to see it, is now about homes and belongings and, sorry, home and belonging, not the object, belonging in a place. And both Mandeep and Karen, who are two artists I'm collaborating with to produce some new work around that theme, both of them are working with me over the winter to create new work for that exhibition. And I will be including in the exhibition some work about the museum that it's going to be in. The exhibition is in a museum which is an old house. So it's a 18th century house turned into a museum quite recently. So I'm going to be doing some work about that something to do with a home turning into a museum and how that kind of changes how we feel about buildings, whether people live in them or not. And I've got a whole series of work that has been ongoing about deserted medieval villages, which is another kind of like English countryside thing, which are they're archaeological sites that were villages, small villages, and that were abandoned or people were forced to leave way back in like the 1400s, 1500s. But there's still kind of lumps and bumps left in the fields, and you can kind of see the like you were talking about these hollowway, the paths, the footpaths that have been cut deep into the ground from generations of people walking on them. So there's quite a lot of those around in the area that I live, and there's lots of them in England. And they're really interesting archaeologically, but I find them interesting to look at the emotional history of people being evicted from their homes and how we look at them now as just as a kind of historic monument, whereas actually they're like the ruins of people's homes, which is, you know, so I'm interested in the emotional side, the emotional histories of that. So I've got a whole new series of work about that kind of area, that kind of work, which will be part of this exhibition about homes and belonging and community, which covers a whole broad selection of things. And yeah, there will be online versions of that. There will be a Making Meaning Journal that will cover that in more detail, and lots more to come, basically. Just loads of things, loads and loads of things, but all really exciting things. So it's really nice to have a chance to talk about them and to share them.
Wow.
Yeah, and especially, you know, with the refugee crisis, that's a whole nother idea with, you know, moving and home, and that's another
in there as well. Yeah, that is in there because this is another subject we can't get into. My grandma was a refugee 100 years ago, so I'm working on things to do with her story. But I don't think they're going to come out in this round of the exhibition, just because I've got quite a lot of other things to do. But that's been a project that's, you know, turning that family history into creative work is an ongoing project that I'll probably be working on for years. But it's, yeah, there are definitely elements of that will come into this, to this exhibition, and it kind of those threads will carry on into future projects as well, because everything I do kind of connects in some way. You know, they all do flow together. Eventually, I sometimes have to kind of draw out those threads and work out how they connect, because there's lots of different ideas, but they'd all connect because they all come from me, and so it's, you know, that they're all part of who I am, and that comes out in what I choose to make.
Yep. Well, Ruth, quite a world you've created for yourself. It's absolutely fascinating, and thanks for making time to share it with us.
You're very welcome. It's been really interesting. Thank you very much.
All right, and thanks to everyone for listening.